I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned into Modus Operandi. In the fall of 2023, a story of East meets West. Xi Jinping arrived in historic San Francisco to streets that were unrecognizable to the locals, cleaned up for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, better known as APEC. Nearly two dozen Pacific Rim world leaders were in attendance, but all eyes were on the Xi and Biden meeting. And that is what we'll focus on today. All right, let's get into the MO. In case you forgot, there's been an ongoing trade war between the U.S. and China for the last 7 years or so. That trade war has found the world's top two economies at loggerheads over everything from technology like Huawei to social media like TikTok and even geopolitics like the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine, but especially over the status of Taiwan. But APEC 2023, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, is supposed to focus purely on money, trade, economics, and, as the name implies, how to better cooperate with one another on these matters. These Pacific Rim countries jointly control the overwhelming majority of trade, goods, and services all around the world. So when two of the 21 key players aren't seeing eye to eye, will the rest of the world lose sight of which way to navigate in the 21st century? Joining us to discuss this complicated relationship between the U.S. and China is Anna Guo. She is a geopolitical analyst and talk show host for CGTN Radio. She's coming to us from Beijing, China. Anna, thank you so much for joining the program today. First, I'd like to hear your top-line thoughts and overall read on the 2023 APEC summit and how it was received by those in China.
So far, I think the meeting has shown positive signs, as I believe the main theme of the meeting was to seek a way forward for the strained ties, and the atmosphere was great in general. The talks of the two presidents lasted 4 hours long. I think that indicates how engaging of their conversation was. It covered a wide range of issues on China-U.S. relations, including establishing an intergovernmental dialogue on artificial intelligence, set up a working group on drug control cooperation, resume high-level communications between the two militaries, and agreed to a further substantial increase in flights earlier next year. That means to expand exchanges in education, youth, culture, sports, and business. They also had an all-round communication on addressing the Palestine and Israel conflict, the Ukraine crisis, climate change, and other global challenges. And more importantly, I think this summit serves as a great opportunity to clarify both China and U.S. stance on major differences or critical issues. For example, President Xi elaborated on China's principled stance regarding the Taiwan question. He said to Mr. Biden that China will realize reunification and this is unstoppable, and urging the U.S. to take the real actions to honor its commitment of not supporting Taiwan independence. This is a strong and clear message directly from the top leader of China. And from Mr. Biden, on the other hand, again, he reaffirmed that the United States does not seek a new Cold War and does not seek to change China's system, does not seek to revitalize its alliances against China and does not support Taiwan independence and has no intention to have a conflict with China. But he also defended the U.S. so-called Indo-Pacific strategy and what Washington believed that the freedom of navigation and overflight, as well as the practice of small circles like AUKUS, etc. I think all of this indicate that although the two sides still have differences on some key issues, but they have indeed demonstrated a common desire to ease tensions between the two countries, you know, to contain the further festering of differences and to maximize the positive aspects of their relationship. So based on what has been released and also the following reactions of the two governments, the overall atmosphere is better than expected. Just one thing I think worth of mentioning is the recent development that the two sides are working together to make climate negotiations a success at COP28, I think, which also signals a very positive approach to bilateral cooperation in the near future.
So APEC boasts 21 member states, but all eyes were really on China's President Xi and his relationship with Joe Biden. How would you characterize that relationship both prior to the summit, and did that dynamic change in any manner after the event, especially after Biden called President Xi a dictator when answering a question from the press?
Let me answer your question, the later part of the question first. I don't want to comment extensively on Mr. Biden's temporary statements on individual issue, because we noticed Blinken's frowning expression during the meeting, and we have also seen similar statements from the president on other occasions. I think it's challenging at times to decipher his true intention based on just one single statement. And about the China-U.S. relations, we tend to divide phases based on significant events such as this summit. But my overall sense is that this summit is just one outcome of a series of interactions and exchanges between the two sides. It's just a small part of a long process. And the complex dynamics of China-U.S. relations could, I think, won't undergo substantial changes due to this just one summit. So I think the best characterization for this critical bilateral relationship may indeed be complex, as it always be, given its extensive scope. It's difficult to determine whether cooperation or confrontation prevails in each phase, as different areas may yield different answers. But if we look back at history, China and the U.S. have rich experiences in dealing with each other. The relationship indeed has had its ups and downs, but it has generally maintained an overall positive trajectory. Since China's reform and opening up, its development has brought enormous benefits to China, US, and the world. And according to a research from JP Morgan, it indicates that Chinese imports contributed to an annual reduction of approximately 40 basis points in the U.S. inflation rate from 2000 to 2010. And iconic American brands like Apple, Microsoft, Ford, Boeing, Citigroup, and many more are well known in China. And every year, hundreds of thousands of Chinese students go to the U.S. for education. And we know before facing suppression from the U.S., Huawei, the Chinese company, provided convenient and cost-effective network services to many regions in the U.S., especially in remote and relatively backward areas where the user base was small. But unfortunately, due to the ban, some areas had to dismantle Huawei equipment or replace it, and significantly increasing internet prices. What I want to express here is China's stance has not changed and will not change because of this one summit. So I believe the central question in the current interactions between China and the U.S. is how the U.S. views China and how it intends to engage with China. Is the U.S. genuinely willing to collaborate with China on global challenges such as climate change, peace and security, and develop cooperation, etc.? Or is China still seen as a rival to be aggressively attacked or suppressed? So I think the ball was and still is in U.S. court. So let's wait and see after this summit.
Yeah, to your point on how the U.S. views China, I mean, over the last few years under both Trump and Biden, we have seen U.S. foreign policy take a decisively aggressive stance toward China, despite all these different attempts at thawing the icy relations after that Trump-era trade war began. We saw Biden host ASEAN leaders here in Washington, D.C. In May of 2022. We've heard bluster coming out of a lot of agencies in regard to Taiwan. Even then Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi taking a trip to Taipei against the wishes of Xi Jinping. We even heard U.S. military officials speaking of plans for war against Beijing, and then followed by the expansion of U.S. military bases in the Philippines. Then you add the U.S. Recently reopening its embassy over in the Solomon Islands, Vice President Kamala Harris hosting the Prime Minister of Mongolia in summer of 2023, where they signed on board to the U.S.-led Open Skies Treaty. That's just to name a few moves. I mean, many have described this as encirclement of China, both physically and figuratively, in the way of influence, sort of like a Kennan strategy. Instead of Russia, it's China. Is this how it's being perceived by Beijing?
I think you made a great point. It seems Washington has almost weaponized all its relations with China over the past years, blaming China for its own domestic and international issues. Washington often denies attempting to contain Beijing, but actions indeed speaks way louder than words. I think the United States, through measures such as export controls, increased military spending, and base expansion, seeks to weaken China's economy and encircle it, even at the risk of sparking conflicts. I think this is a dangerous and unnecessary policy. The U.S. has pursued military containment policies before, and the results have been disastrous for millions worldwide. Even the architect of the containment strategy, as you mentioned, George Kennan, later regretted supporting such practices. In the latter part of his life, he became a staunch critic of Cold War policies and expressed remorse over the U.S. Soviet arm race. He constantly warned about the dangers of militarism and nuclear war and expressed concerns about superpowers repeating the mistakes of war. So I think if Kennan were to witness the intensifying competition between U.S. and China today, I think he would undoubtedly be shocked that the U.S. is once again heading down the path of confrontational policies from decades ago, because I think containing China will inevitably evolve sustained military expansion and explosive growth in military spending. I believe the U.S. currently faces many deep-rooted issues at home, such as widening wealth inequality, high inflation, low incomes, the increasing unemployment. These are the issues that really require taxpayers' money to address. So continue to contain and surprise China will only lead to excessive military expansion, unnecessary competition, and wasteful spending. And more importantly, I want to mention here is that China is not Soviet Union. The Swedish Institute for Security and Development Policy believes the success of U.S. containment strategy against the Soviet Union during the Cold War was due to the limited economic context between the Eastern and Western blocs. The West could easily leverage the Soviet Union's allies with its abundant material production. But in the era of economic globalization, China is the largest trading partner of almost all neighboring countries and regions. No country is willing to reduce its economic ties with China to align with the U.S. containment strategy. Take the ASEAN, for example. China is the largest trading partner of ASEAN, and ASEAN countries have benefited greatly from trade with China. And in contrast, the United States is quite stingy in this regard. During last year's U.S.-ASEAN summit, Mr. Biden only provided $150 million U.S. dollar in aid to 10 ASEAN countries. So I think That's why we haven't seen much reports on the follow-ups of the so-called Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. And to the world, I think, if we go back to the, if we go go have a look at the data from World Bank, for example, the U.S. had a GDP of just around $25 trillion last year, while China was approximately $18 trillion, accounting for more than a third of global economy when they combined. And China and the U.S. have nearly a quarter of world's population, and their bilateral trade account for about one-fifth of a world's total. So the relationship is way too important to be messed up or to indulge with short-sighted emotions. So I think in this case, major country competition is not the only way out for them. And the world, as President Xi said during the meeting, the world is big enough for the two countries to succeed, and one country's success is an opportunity for the other. And that actually has been proven right over the years of China-U.S. close cooperation before all those drama started.
Yeah, $150 million is pocket change for the U.S. And then this spread among more than a dozen Asian states is quite cheap, if you ask me. All right, coming up next, the host city for APEC 2023, San Francisco, carries a lot of historical importance for U.S.-China relations. So former mayor turned governor of California, Gavin Newsom, rolled out the red carpet for President Xi. We'll discuss it when we return with Anna Ge. Sit tight, the MO will be right back. Welcome back to the MO. I'm Manila Chan. So just 2 weeks before President Joe Biden greeted President Xi in San Francisco, President Xi welcomed California's Governor Newsom to Beijing. Is this a signal that something bigger is brewing for Newsom beyond California's borders? Anna Ge, geopolitical analyst and radio host, is back with us. Thank you for sticking around with us, Anna. So the host city for APEC this year was San Francisco, a historically important city for Chinese Americans, a symbol of Chinese relations. Chinatown, a hub for many Asian immigrants in the surrounding area. This once beautiful city has been plagued by homelessness and open-air drug use in recent years. California's Governor Gavin Newsom took great measures to clean up his hometown ahead of this summit, many say, particularly for President Xi. But just a few weeks before he greeted Xi in San Francisco, Governor Newsom paid President Xi an official visit to Beijing. Much of the American press ignored this trip by Governor Newsom. What was the purpose of Newsom's trip to Beijing? I mean, we know California has direct trade coming from China, given it's on the Pacific coast. But wouldn't trade issues be discussed at APEC a few weeks later anyway? So why this special trip by Newsom?
First of all, I think San Francisco and California indeed hold special significance in the context of China-U.S. relations. This connection dates back to the Chinese laborers who came to the U.S. to build railroads, and even earlier. On China's National Day, October 1st this year, the City Hall in San Francisco even raised the Chinese national flag for a celebration. And as you mentioned, everyone is well aware of the economic and trade ties between China and California, whether it's the high-tech companies in Silicon Valley or the traditional shipping and trade sectors. California indeed plays a crucial role in China-U.S. economic cooperation. So in that case, I think Governor Newsom's visit to China is not a surprise. I think similar visits are well-planned and prepared for over the long term. But what I want to emphasize is that whether it's San Francisco, California, or Governor Newsom, They don't just represent a city, a state, or a governor. They represent a rational, pragmatic attitude towards China within the United States, reflecting the view of many, I think. For example, around the same time as Governor Newsom's visit, a significant number of American visitors, including including members of Congress, prominent business leaders, they also visited China. This rational attitude has existed for a long time, but in the current political environment in the United States, I think this their voices have been suppressed or in some cases are afraid to be expressed. As you mentioned earlier, for some time now, the United States has taken a series of misguided actions in its relationship with China, actions that appear quite negative from the Chinese perspective. Therefore, I think Governor Newsom's visit to China holds another important significance that is tells the Chinese people there are still individuals in the United States who support cooperation with China, who maintain a calm and a rational mindset. The extreme views of certain politicians do not represent the entire of the United States. This is crucial, I think, for future direction of bilateral relations, because in developing relations with the U.S., the Chinese government also needs to consider the needs and the sentiment of its own people. And of course, recent American visitors to China, including Governor Newsom, should not be simply labeled as pro-China. I believe compared to politicians who have been calling for confrontation, they simply prioritize the long-term interests of U.S. Over the short-term gains. As I mentioned earlier, cooperation between China and the U.S. is very beneficial for both countries. The recently departed Dr. Henry Kissinger is a representative figure in this regard. He is widely known in China. I would like to express my condolences for his passing, but I understand that Dr. Kissinger's stance on China has faced criticism from some American media, but his perspective is precisely what the United States needs now, a clear and rational understanding and attitude towards China. The U.S. needs new figures like Kissinger, a politician who constantly consider long-term interests of the American people when dealing with China. So there is a discussion in China recently. Will Governor Newsom to be the next Kissinger in China-U.S. relationship? I'm not sure on that, but I hope there are more Kissinger figures emerge in the United States and more rational voices in the U.S. when dealing with China.
Yes, Kissinger was a very controversial political figure here in the U.S., to say the least. But to his credit, he did open the door to the modern relations between U.S. and China. So lastly, where does the U.S. and China go from here? Biden is facing a tough re-election cycle. In a year's time, it's possible Xi Jinping could be negotiating with someone else as POTUS. Is China looking beyond the 2024 U.S. elections in its own calculus for its relationship with the U.S.?
As I mentioned earlier, China-U.S. relations may not always be smooth. They generally have a positive trajectory. In the words of Chinese official expression, there are 1,000 reasons for China and the U.S. to improve their relations and not a single reason to worsen them. But of course, bilateral relations cannot depend solely on China's side. So if we look at past situation, China has always been a hot topic during U.S. elections. For some candidates, demonstrating a tough stance towards China seems to be the most effective way to appeal to voters, though this may be not entirely accurate, because according to my discussions with many American friends, they seem more concerned about domestic issues such as healthcare, infrastructure, tax rates, etc. But I think that really should be the focus, right? From China's perspective, I think the long-term development trend of China-US relations will not change because of a single election, because no matter which party or political figure comes to power, there are some basic facts that cannot, or at least will be difficult to change in the short term, such as the huge economic and trade ties between the two countries, such as the long-term close exchanges. Another example is the shared responsibility of the two countries on issues such as climate change, peace, and security. You know, in the areas they try to forge more cooperation between the two sides. So therefore, China's policy on China-US relations involves expressing core concerns, making it clear what issues are non-negotiable red lines, such as supporting Taiwan independence or instigating the separation of China. This is definitely non-negotiable. Those are the red lines of China. And it also involves demonstrating a sincere willingness to cooperate and being open to collaboration in areas where both sides can and should work together.
Anna Ge, geopolitical expert and talk show host for CGTN Radio, thank you so much for your insight today. All right, that is going to do it for this episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign policy and current affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next time to figure out the MO.